Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Thursday, March 28th. We'll talk now about the Francis Scott Key Bridge tragedy in Baltimore, but pull out the lens for a New York, New Jersey, and national view. How did this actually happen? Was it a fluke, or does it reveal some kind of national systemic risk given today's ships and bridges? And we'll use the opportunity to just explain how some of our maritime infrastructure works. We take this for granted, right? When we drive or take trains over the many bridges in our lives, or when we buy products that arrive on giant ships, or when we go on ships and boats ourselves. So with us now are Brian Buckman, a structural engineer and CEO of Buckman Engineering based in Brooklyn. They do bridge and maritime engineering. And Peter Ford, founder of Skyrock Advisors. They do port and maritime infrastructure management and are based in the Charlotte, North Carolina area. He's originally from New York, though, I understand, and went to school around here, went to the United States Merchant Marine Academy for college. Brian and Peter, thank you both for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the invitation.
Can I ask you each to start by just talking a little bit about your companies and the kinds of work they do? You know, these are not the kinds of businesses, as you well know, that make it into the news very much until something goes wrong, like happened in Baltimore. So, Brian Buckman, would you start? What does Buckman Engineering, based in Brooklyn, do? What kinds of projects or any other way you want to describe your company?
Well, yeah, sure. So I'm a structural engineer, and I focus in work related to bridges and maritime structures. So I'll do anything from bridge pier protection to traditional piers to ferry terminals. So usually the interaction between structures and vessels once they come into contact with the structure. Lately I've been busy with some new construction and some rehabilitation work.
All right. And Peter Ford, same question for Skyrock Advisors in the context of infrastructure management. Do you manage the kinds of things that Brian's company designs and builds?
So, yeah, thanks, Brian. I'm actually an advisor as opposed to a manager. So we advise infrastructure funds, port authorities, terminal owners, and in the port maritime space. We help them identify, you know, business challenges and opportunities for improvements, both in infrastructure as well as operations. And we advise on mergers and acquisition transactions. So we kind of have an overall mandate in and around the space as it involves operations and infrastructure, including the construction specifications, not from an engineering perspective, but from a commercial and use requirement. And unfortunately, as you rightly mentioned, the last couple of years, we've been talking an awful lot about supply chain, ports, and whatnot. So there's been a lot of people interested in what I do lately.
Yeah, I also see you're a member of the Cornell Program and Infrastructure Policy Advisory Board. They teach this stuff at Cornell?
They teach the infrastructure policy at Cornell and how to get infrastructure built, what's the best methodology for putting out contracts and bids and regulatory environment. And I, of course, provide some insight and help on, what does it look like from a maritime perspective and a port requirement perspective, which sometimes has a little bit of a different take than bridges and tolls and roads and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and we'll get into some regulatory and policy questions as we go, and whether the accident in Baltimore implies any need for regulatory change. But Brian, let me go back to you and just ask you, basically, with your expertise in this field as a structural engineer, what happened in Baltimore? I mean, for the untrained eye watching on television, it was shocking to see that bridge, that big, long, major piece of infrastructure, appear to crumble like a child's toy. So what physically happened there to cause that collapse?
I'll say firstly that I don't have a tremendous background in the actual structural details of the bridge, but as a concept, the vessel, lost steerage, and when it rammed into the pier, it was a tremendous amount of kinetic energy. You know, you have a massive vessel and it's going, going several miles an hour. I think I've heard figures of between, 6 and 8 knots. So, you know, that's a decent speed.
That's about 9 miles an hour, as I understand it, for people who don't know knots, right?
Yes. So that's a tremendous amount of energy, and it doesn't just stop when it hits the bridge. So there's going to be a balance of where does that energy go, and I think in this case the bridge wasn't enough to stop all of that energy. It's a very rare condition, a very rare accident. You don't see it very often. But once that one pier goes, the structure really doesn't have a chance of staying up when you lose one out of the two main supports. So
just one vocabulary word. When you say the ship hit the pier, that's not like a pier that you fish off. That pier, as you use that word, is part of the bridge, right?
Right. So in the context that I'm speaking right now, the pier is the main support. So that would go from the underside of the spanning part all the way down to the foundation. So that would be sort of the substructure of the pier, of the bridge.
And I'll stay with you for one more question in this set before we go to Peter on some things about the ship. You said this is rare, and obviously if it was less rare, we'd hear about these things in the news more. But how much of a fluke does that appear to you to have been, and how much of something that could happen to lots of bridges from lots of ships and lots of places?
Yeah, I think it's sort of difficult to answer just because every sort of bridge over a navigable channel has their own nuances. I think for the most part, the standard procedure when the ship is performing properly and the captains are always doing their best to be in control of the ship, it's very rare. So usually there is some sort of a fluke happening, like a rare case that the ship loses power or loses control, or the operator has a medical emergency at a critical juncture. I think it's exceedingly rare that this sort of accident happens.
Peter, the reporting I've seen says the ship sent a mayday call reporting it lost power, but that it continued toward the bridge at a high rate of speed anyway for a vessel like that, about 9 miles an hour, as you said. Do you know enough to explain why, if it lost power, it wouldn't have slowed to a stop?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's important to remember, and exactly what Brian just talked about, this kinetic energy. Momentum plays a major role, and of course, ships don't have brakes. If the power, propulsion, and steerage all went out, then there's no ability to put the vessel astern to put it in reverse, and so it would just continue on, only being affected by the current. And as we saw, actually, in this case, the current did push the vessel out of the track, out of the channel, pushing the bow, the front of the vessel, to starboard or pointing south a little bit, which then caused it to hit that southern pier, as Brian called it. Just for technicalities, the vessel maneuverability guidelines typically look for, on a ship this size, even if you put the vessel full astern, put it fully in reverse, 100%, it would take 15 times the length of the ship to stop.
Wow. Uh-huh.
So that's two. That's about 2.8 miles, if we think about that. And so that's at full speed, of course. The vessel was not at full speed. It was about at, just slightly half speed, if you will, at the 8.5 knots or 9 knots. So we could reduce that. But by the time the vessel lost power and everybody understood what was happening, it was less than a nautical mile. It was less than a mile from the bridge itself. So I would say that the efforts that the pilot made to call and stop traffic, drop the anchor, call for tug assistance, despite the fact that there was no ability to get there in time. He did everything. They did everything that they possibly could, other than having the power restored itself.
Right. So with the loss of power, the captain couldn't steer it away from the bridge. That's one of the things that the power enables him or her to
correct.
Do, right?
So yeah. Power, yeah, the power to the steerage, that the rudders are massive. Again, these ships are incredibly large, and so the rudder would probably be itself about 10 or 15, 10 meters high. It requires hydraulic motors to drive the arms and move it starboard and port or left and right. And without that power, there would be very little chance of being able to move that rudder. There is a manual station, typically, you know, for an emergency, but it's usually for emergencies at sea. They send somebody way down to the bottom of the ship, and then there's a manual, you know, crank, if you will, to start to push this. But that's a very long process, and usually only used to, as I said, out at sea to help the ship continue to maneuver, as opposed to in tight spaces like we saw here. It would not have been successful, especially since rudders typically only work well when the water is moving through them from the propeller itself.
You know, we did a segment earlier in the week on the safety problems at Boeing. And a listener writes, please tie it all together. This is related to the same reasons Boeing is having issues too. Capitalism is to blame. Deregulation and the need to squeeze as much profit out of shops as possible, maybe they meant to write ships, size, less crew, as well as bridges, fewer safeties, structures to block wayward ships, etc., have made everyone less safe. Now, you guys both own or manage businesses, so I don't know that you're going to be in a position to do a structural critique of capitalism. But as you listen to that, Brian, does the writer have a point?
You know, I think for current structures and things that are being built today and in recent years, the codes are so so safety focused, and many of the clients, if not all the clients, are very safety focused, and a whole multitude of loading conditions and threats are considered, and I think, you know, when you have some of the older structures that weren't designed for it, I think then you're in sort of a retrofit situation. So that's just ongoing work. I think, you know, it's sort of a game where you're always behind, you know, but, you know, the ships get larger and all of your previous vessel collision studies are sort of out of date. So you know, it's a constant updating, in the same way that, you know, trucks are getting heavier, that we understand some of the more natural phenomenon. So yeah, I mean, I think it's, I don't suspect that there's corners being cut. I think it's just, you know, how well can you keep up with the changing understanding and development of loads.
So Peter, are there politics involved with keeping our infrastructure up to date to accommodate technology that develops to make companies more money and give consumers more convenience with these larger ships you were describing before, for example? You know, maybe your job at that company is to help fend off new regulation. I don't know. But does regulation need to keep up with shipping technology, and does it, in your opinion?
So I think here's where we're going to see a little bit of a Venn diagram, an overlap between policy around infrastructure creation and policy around infrastructure creation and regulation and policy around shipping and maritime activities. I think on one hand, on the policy around shipping and maritime activities, no, we have the SOLAS, or Safety of Life at Sea, conventions agreed to by, you know, all of the major shipping entities around the world, including the United States, including Singapore, which this is a Singapore flagged vessel. So there are, you know, regulations and guidelines everybody is supposed to live up to. The Coast Guard is out there regularly enforcing them. They do an amazing job all over the country, making sure that the waterways are safe. So I don't think deregulation on that side is to blame for anything. I think, you know, innovation in increasing size has certainly, you know, but from the initial containerization founding to today with the increased vessel size, has reduced the cost of shipping tremendously, allowing us to live the way that we do. And then, so here where I do think that there is some improvement is the reaction, the public reaction to the private innovations that Brian was talking about, and that when private innovation comes out with something great and new and better, and that requires an adjustment by public authorities, whether it be guidelines, infrastructure, upgrading, or otherwise, that's when we do see politics playing a role, and we see the process required to get something funded, designed, and built is far longer, you know, in many places where the government, state governments, federal governments get involved than when private sector does it.
And there we leave it with Brian Buckman, a structural engineer and CEO of Buckman Engineering based in Brooklyn. They do bridge and maritime engineering. And Peter Ford, who is founder of Skyrock Advisors, a port and maritime infrastructure advisor. I think I mistakenly used the word manager before, but for whatever that difference is, a port and maritime infrastructure advisor, that company. And he is a member of the Cornell Program in Infrastructure Policy Advisory Board. Thank you both so much for sharing your expertise. I really, really appreciate it. And I know our listeners do too.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.